What's in store for your business this week at Staples?
Doing business like a CEO while saving like a CFO.
Staples has all the supplies you need to run your business like a boss at prices that'll make your bookkeeper smile.
Now that is an achievement.
Everything from markers and pens to 2019 desk calendars.
And right now, a 12-pack of Sharpie markers and an 8-pack of Expo dry erase markers are only $4.99 each.
At Staples, where there's a whole lot in store. Ends 1/19/19 in store only.
The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Yes, I'm here. I heard the countdown. I figure, okay, the phone probably will blow up in my hand.
So how are you doing? How's the weather down there?
Well, it was not good this morning. I blew my tennis game because it was raining like a son of a gun. Naturally, because I'm not playing this afternoon,
no,
the sun is shining brightly. Okay, I'm yours to command.
All right, so let's get started.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we meet with the legendary Herschel Gordon Lewis on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we'll speak with the infamous Herschel Gordon Lewis, perhaps single-handedly responsible for creating the nudie cutie, roughie, and gore film genres. Herschel has systematically touched on practically every conceivable exploitation film genre during an amazingly prolific 12-year career as producer, writer, director, and frequent scorer of an incredible 38 films. A true giant in 60s drive-in cult film, Herschel has given us such fan favorites as Blood Feast, 2000 Maniacs, She Devils on Wheels, and The Wizard of Gore, as well as being responsible for a number of JD films, down-home hillbilly country epics, political satire, and even kiddie films. Join us as we speak to the godfather of gore himself, Herschel Gordon Lewis, only here at Third Eye Cinema. Coming up in part one of Herschel's monologue, where he speaks about the early days and the nudies, only here on Third Eye Cinema. We have with us today a man who really needs no introduction to fans of cult, drive-in, and exploitation filmmaking. Please join me in welcoming the one and only Herschel Gordon Lewis. Herschel, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be with you, and I could use all the introduction you can add on there.
So how does one go from being a college English professor with a PhD to exploitation filmmaking? You know, perhaps that's why your films interest me, because there's a bit more going on than standard films in the genre.
Well, I've come to the conclusion, really, that the driving force of anybody's destiny is serendipity. You find what you're not looking for.
Right.
The only negative part of that is you don't find what you are looking for. As you just said, I started what I laughingly call my career as a school teacher. I was teaching English literature, and in fact, I drew the golden straw.
Right.
I had English poetry of the Victorian era.
Oh, wow.
Which was the golden age of English poetry. To this day, I could recite Browning endlessly without having to refer to any notes or text. And I said, okay, that's my life. And the benefit, of course, of being an academician is that one set of lecture notes lasts a lifetime. These people are not about to write any more poetry. And that's all you ever need. And the only nasty aspect is having the grade papers. But all right, that's not so terrible. But by spell clutch of circumstance, I drifted into the world of broadcasting and then into advertising. And from that, in the course of making television commercials, I bought a half interest in an old film studio in Chicago, and the evolution is really peculiar if you want to reconstruct it, because that studio where we were shooting commercials had only 16-millimeter equipment. And when I bought in, I became aware that the big advertising agencies were shooting all their stuff in 35-millimeter, which is why they went to California to shoot. I said, aha, I'll
right.
compete with these fellas. So I took a mortgage out on my entire lifetime to get 35-millimeter movie equipment, and the big agencies still went to California to shoot their commercials. So, I had a part-time job at a little a mail-order agency in Chicago
right.
to try to keep Kraft dinner on the table until something happened. One day, I was complaining, and this really goes back to ancient Greek drama, which had a device called Deus Ex Machina. And when Aeschylus or Aristophanes or somebody would write himself into a corner, no problem, the heavens would open up, a basket would come down, and God would solve all their problems just by making a detailed analysis. Well, my Deus Ex Machina was a fellow I barely knew. I was complaining, and he said, well, how do you make any money in the movie business? And I said, with the brashness I then had and probably still have, I said, well, the only way to make money in the movie business is to shoot features. So why don't you shoot features? And why aren't you rich? Some of these questions were absolutely impossible. So I said, oh, nobody shoots features in Chicago. He says, nonsense. Charlie Chaplin shot his first features in Chicago. That planted a nasty seed, and I decided to shoot features. And going into that end of the business, I made more mistakes than I had ever made before, which was tough for me after having made so many. But it was truly an education. And the result of that, we're talking about it today.
Right.
So I guess I can't complain totally.
You were also very much known for trying your hand at, if not being directly responsible for creating, a large number of trends in exploitation film. You pretty much pioneered, alongside Doris Wishman, who seemed to trail directly behind you, both the 60s nudie cutie film and the roughie before coming up with the gore film. And you later proceeded to tap into other exploitation genres like the biker film, the JD film, the kiddie film, before taking things to some real extremes with Wizard of Gore, and in particular the Gore Gore Girls, and then you hung it up and moved into the world of direct marketing for many years. So tell us about two prominent names in independent film who you were involved with, Dave Friedman and Bill Rabane. How did you wind up falling out with Friedman?
You're dangerous. You know way, way, way too much. I'm going to have to get some of the boys to take care of you. Well, Dave Friedman really was an inspiration to me. When
right.
I made the first feature, and I did not know then what I know so thoroughly now, which is any schmuck can make a picture.
Right.
But getting it played somewhere, that requires talent. Trying to scout around, how am I going to get this movie distributed? Somebody referred me to a little film distributorship, which was in what was then called Film Row, on the south end of Wabash Avenue in Chicago. For a whole bunch of independent distributors, that entire concept, by the way, is long gone now. Because any of those distributors who had substance was now swallowed up by a major company, and the ones that didn't have simply disappeared. And the whole distribution technique has changed now, where many movies are going directly to DVD.
Right.
This was called Modern Film Distributors, and it was run by a crusty old guy named Irwin Joseph. Irwin Joseph had a young assistant named David F. Friedman. Dave Friedman and I connected almost immediately. We were similar. Dave was about 5-6 years older than I, but we were of the same vintage. He hadn't yet had the time in the business to harden into cement. He had been a publicity man at Paramount, and he used to flash pictures of himself with Cecil B. DeMille. And I didn't know whether he had simply pasted two photographs together or what, but that was part of his background, and he understood the nature of exploitation. And so in discussing my film project, Dave had a couple of comments which turned out to be absolutely smack in the middle of the target, and that's when I said, I've got to make a deal with this fellow. One of the comments he made was something I should have seen myself. At the time, I had an arrangement to direct independently for a company in Chicago called Fred Niles Communications. Niles was simply a film studio is all it was. And I listened to Fred Niles, who referred me to a screenwriter. His name was Robert Abel. It shows how significant these things were that all these years later I remember these names. Well, you see, Shakespeare said, the evil that men do lived after them, and the good is oft interred with them. Bones. And so I remember the names of the people who were negative in my life, and I've forgotten too many of the positives. Well, anyway, Robert Abel wrote this screenplay called The Prime Time. That was the first movie I made, and I made, every mistake any novice possibly could make. First of all, I was the producer. I wasn't going to get my hands dirty directing this picture. So I made a deal with one of Fred Niles' directors to direct this movie. And that also was a terrible mistake because this fellow, as good as he was at lighting and shooting beer cans, had no concept of drama. And so it was a stick figure kind of thing. And at the time, because I was playing producer, I didn't complain or take over the way I should have. Out came this movie, The Prime Time. And we had formed a company called Mid-Continent Films. And Mid-Continent had raised enough money to make two features. The Prime Time was the first one. And I was the biggest investor, which made sense, obviously, because it was my deal. Every one of my then friends had invested something in Mid-Continent Films. All right, so we had The Prime Time. Now what? Dave Friedman looked at this movie and said, well, I'll see what I can do with it. And the more I saw of it, the less I wanted to have anything to do with it, which I couldn't. It was my movie. Dave was able to get this movie opened in a couple of places, and I found that astounding that he could do that. He even had a number of world premieres in which members of the cast, obviously all unknowns, would appear and sign autographs for people that Dave had planted there to ask for autographs. Right. I found that very impressive. So up came the second movie, which I took a little more control over, and that's the one I directed. It was called Living Venus,
right,
which was the rise and fall of a character loosely based on Hugh Hefner. The result of Living Venus was a good deal more positive. First of all, the plot line was actually a plot line.
Right.
Which was somewhat helpful, and it was right at the height of Hefner's early successes, which meant that there was a factor there, even though we made it very clear that we were not actually basing this as a biographical sketch of this individual. But it was strong enough that some theaters would book this picture. Now, please understand, at that time, the only outlet for an independent movie was the theater. There were no video cassettes. There were no DVDs. You made it in the theater or not at all. Here's a schmuck in Chicago with no actors, no effects worth anything, trying to get his picture played. And that's why Dave Friedman became an instant hero with me. He was able to do that. Eventually, the other shoe drops. And so time went by, and I began to realize that Mid-Continent Films was not getting any film rentals from film distributors. Oh, it'll come, it'll come. This was not from Dave, but this was from Irwin Joseph. Eventually, modern film distributors went out of business. And they went out of business so quickly and so abruptly that we were stunned by the whole thing. Meanwhile, here I am with Mid-Continent Films and co-investors saying, hey, when are we going to get some money? So suddenly, I had no company, I had no future, I had no friends. They were all investors in Mid-Continent Films. And so I was able to get a job with another film studio in Chicago, United Film and Recording, it was called, on
right.
Erie Street, as their director for commercial. I had no office. I had a chair in the screening room. And when they wanted to look at some film, I had to move aside so my shadow would not be on the screen. One of a great number of low points in my career. But the other factor, you know, again, as Shakespeare said, sweet are the uses of adversity.
Yes.
Dave Friedman was out of a job. His company had gone out of business. What was he supposed to do? Dave wasn't the director. Dave was really a contact person. What was he to do? So Dave was scouting around trying to find some means for him to put dinner on the table. We stayed loosely in contact, although neither one of us was that eager to have anything going when we had nothing going. But one fine day, Dave came into United Film and Recording, where I had my office, and he said, do you still have that Mitchell camera? I said, yes, I do. It's sitting in the closet here. He said, all right. He says, Al Sack, another name I remember, distributor in Dallas, Texas, will give us $7,000. We will make a one-reel movie in color, 35-millimeter color, pretty girls cavorting in the sun.
Okay.
Is that a cat I hear?
Yes, it is.
Oh, bully for you. I hope it's a feral cat. That's in keeping with our conversation.
He's just playing off toy.
That's my warped sense of humor. I figured this way. He wants a one-reeler. Dave told me he could get four girls at $50 a day each. I could use my camera. I could use the editing equipment there at United Film. I figured we'd have a musical soundtrack. In that studio, they had a piano, an organ, and a celeste. I would play the theme myself. We would have no charge of any sort for composing the music or playing it. And our only cost would be the cost of film, the cost of making work print, the cost of transferring the sound, the musical track, onto actual soundtrack, and then the first print. I felt that he and I could each come out of there with $2,000 cash, which at the time, that was a lot of money. I said, let's do it, baby. Well, at that point, and I had a hard time trying to explain at home what I was up to. I still have that problem. Well, what happened then was a fellow with a laboratory in New York, Gofanti Film Lab, with whom I'd done some business, came wandering into United Film and Recording looking for business.
Right.
He said, what are you working on? And I said, well, we've got this deal, and if I can make a deal with you to do the laboratory work. And I explained that we were going to shoot a one-reel picture of pretty girls cavorting in the sun. He said, hold it. If you will make a full-length feature of at least 70 minutes length, I'll make you a deal where no laboratory bills are due until 90 days after we deliver the answer print. My first reaction was, I don't want to get back into that mess. But my second reaction, after conversations with Dave, was a little different. He said he was quite convinced if we could make a movie 70 minutes long, he could get that thing played, and we owed no money until 90 days after the answer print. And our only cost would be the actual raw film, not even the processing of it. And I said, jeepers, we could probably do this provided that by 90 days after we get the answer print, we have some income from it. So we agreed to make that, and the result of that was a little movie called The Adventures of Lucky Pierre. And you talk about a movie that was a life changer. Lucky Pierre truly was. I think really it's more because of Lucky Pierre than Blood Feast that you and I are having this conversation today. Well, the next question was, can we do this without having to dig deep into our pockets? As I think you're aware, a 35-millimeter movie film goes through the camera at 90 feet a minute, which means that a finished 70-minute movie is 6,300 feet of film. By the way, today you can't make a movie 70 minutes long. It's just too short. At that time, for that kind of movie, 70 minutes was considered the minimum to get first position when theaters showed a double feature. So it was a legitimate length. In order to make a movie 6,300 feet long, we only bought 8,000 feet of film. We used absolutely every inch of film that we bought. In fact, I remember one scene where I said to this girl, stretch. She thought I said, scratch. And she did. And we left it in. Not because in a movie of the type of Lucky Pierre, which is a sort of a dingbat, knock 'em off the wall kind of thing, so
right.
What? There were a couple of scenes in there with sync sound. Now what? We needed a clapstick. Dave and I were the entire crew. I was the director and cameraman. He was the producer and sound man. And that was it. That was the crew. So in a couple of scenes in which we had actors who had to talk and we needed a clapstick,
right. They
ran their own clapstick, threw it aside, and started to act. It was that casual an approach. Well, in came the answer print of The Adventures of Lucky Pierre, and we were stupefied. It was so horrible. And we didn't care about the acting. To this day, nobody cares about the acting in that kind of a movie.
Right.
What we cared about is this was in the days before they had computerized what they call timing, which is the lightening and darkening of scenes.
Right.
And within one sequence, you would have very dark scenes and very light scenes, and it was all over the place. I said, oh, my God, now what? That is the answer print. In fact, the reason they call it answer print is because you make changes based on what you see in that first print. But that's all we had was the answer print, and they weren't going to make any more, but we paid for that, which we had to do within 90 days. Now what? Well, Dave had a friend named Tom Dowd who ran a little theater at the south end of Chicago's Loop. The theater was called the Capri, and the Capri played oddball pictures. And believe me, we had an oddball picture. Tom Dowd agreed to play the answer print of Lucky Pierre. The movie ran 9 weeks. It broke the house record, and it gave me forever a cynical approach to movie making. Suddenly, I was back in the movie business with both feet, and I said, great balls of fire, if a movie this primitive can do this kind of business, no matter what I do, it's bound to be better than this. And that is the reason behind the first part of the question that you asked to start this conversation.
Right.
I began to grind this stuff out like just so much hamburger. And Dave and I became partners. And within the industry, word got out very quickly. Here are two guys with no talent, no equipment, no actors worth crap. They will get this movie done in a couple of days, and they can have it edited and out on the street within a month and a half. Let's make a deal with them. So in addition to making movies for ourselves, we were making movies for others. And we had pretty much a corner on that type of movie. Russ Meyer was making movies with pretty girls, but we had two things he didn't have. We had a sense of humor. Russ Meyer never had a sense of humor. As talented as he was, and as I think you may know, he came to something of a tragic end. He developed Alzheimer's, and it was really sad to see what once had been Russ Meyer simply slowly disintegrate. But he took the industry very seriously, which we didn't. He wanted to glamorize. We wanted to entertain. So we had an edge because invariably Russ's movies cost 5 or 6 times what ours did without doing any more business than ours did. So strictly from the viewpoint of business organization, we had an edge. But as always happens, word got out. And everybody who was making independent movies said, hey, hold it. How long has this been going on? And at a certain point, and the industry itself began to take a turn I didn't like. I had small children at the time. I felt it was difficult enough trying to explain to them what I was doing. And I just felt that we had to go in a different direction. Dave agreed. So we sat down one day after having witnessed an invasion where some of the movies we had planned to get played were replaced very quickly by movies others had made of the same type we did. And Tom Dowd, who originally played Lucky Pierre, began to make a bunch of movies, which was good for me because I directed all of Tom Dowd's movies, under a fake name, by the way. But it was indicative of what was happening, that the thing was becoming so crowded and the number of theaters was not expanding. So what we had was a lot more product with no other places to play that product. It did not take Einstein to figure out that the end was coming, that where you either, we or anybody, either had to make a much more violent kind of a product or go in another direction.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Herschel Gordon Lewis. Coming up, part two of Herschel's monologue, where he speaks about the gore films that Friedman split. Well, you're on Third Eye Cinema. Thank you.
tried to figure out what direction might be there in which we could exploit our, I won't say our talents. I never claimed talent, and I never revered talent.
Right.
I revere imagination, which is a different story altogether. So one night, and I'll take credit for this one, I was watching television late at night, and here was this gangster movie with Edward G. Robinson or somebody, and the police pumped this fellow full of bullet holes, and he died peacefully with a little splotch on the front of his shirt, eyes closed, and I said, just a minute here. That's not right. And that gave us the notion for a movie that would go a step beyond. At the time, we had set up, whenever we came to Florida to shoot a movie, we would do that because the weather was turning cold in Chicago. That's how casual the approach was. Hey, it's getting cold. Let's go shoot a movie. We were staying at a little motel on the North Beach called the Suez Motel. And I'm still in mourning. They tore the Suez down about 4 years ago. Some film nut sent me some pieces of cement from the Suez Motel, which I had that on a table for about a week, and my wife said, what is that doing there? I said, well, that's remnants of the Suez. She said, you're a remnant of the Suez. So that little piece of history is long gone. But outside the Suez Motel was a sphinx. Now, a sphinx is a sphinx. You may have been to Giza in Egypt, as I have, and seen the actual sphinx. The sphinx outside the Suez was only about 8 feet tall, and it was made out of cement, but it was a sphinx. And against the sky, what difference does it make whose sphinx you're looking at? And so, that sphinx really activated a lot of sphincters. That gave me a notion for the Egyptian overtone that underlay the movie which we called Blood Feast. Now, I know you're familiar with the plot line of Blood Feast,
yeah,
which another primitive proposition. A woman goes to a Fuad Ramses, which was the most Egyptian name I could think of. And the sign outside says Fuad Ramses Exotic Catering, which
right,
it certainly was. She said, Mr. Ramses, I'd like to have a party for my daughter, but I don't want it to be like anybody else's party. Madam, have you ever had an Egyptian feast? Well, no, but has there been a party like that? Not for 5,000 years. As it turns out, an Egyptian feast are the body parts of young maidens, hard to find in Miami, by the way, cut up and cooked. And that's the Egyptian feast. Quite often I've been asked, who wrote the script for Blood Feast? And my answer always has been, the what? What's that? We really shot that movie as we went. We had a notion of what we were going to do, but nobody, not ourselves, not anybody in the cast or crew, when we had a little crew by that time, about three or four people just really for help pick up the cables. Nobody took it seriously, and it was only when I was cutting that movie in my little cutting room in Chicago, people would see this horrible work print covered with grease pencil and say, is this a medical film? What are you doing here? And I said, uh-oh, whoever is going to play this movie? Once again, we have taken a chance far beyond logic.
Right.
Not that logic ever had a point in the movie business. It still doesn't have any place in the movie industry. The relationship between what somebody spends on a movie and what the movie takes in is nonsense. There is no relationship. It's independent or major company product. Well, as it turned out, the fellow who played Fuad Ramses was a young actor named Mal Arnold, who in the previous movie we had made, Scum of the Earth, played a young teenage punk. And only a few weeks elapsed. It's like one of these medical novelties in which somebody ages suddenly from age 18 to age 80 in a matter of weeks.
Right.
Well, Mel Arnold did that, and he became Fuad Ramses. We put some silver-colored shoe polish in his hair, and that's all we needed. Once again, to this moment, as we sit here today, people don't go to see one of these movies because of the quality of acting or the caliber of screenwriting.
Right.
They go because they want to come out of the movie saying, holy smoke, did you see that?
Right.
So we decided to open Blood Feast in Peoria, figuring if we die in Peoria, who will know? In fact, if Peoria tonight is wiped off the map, who will know that it's not there anymore? We opened the movie in Peoria, and Dave and I took the pledge we weren't going to go anywhere near that place. The movie opened on Friday. By Saturday, we couldn't stand it. Peoria's 100-and-some miles from Chicago. We figured, oh, what? So we decided to drive down there to see our movie. And we got to within about a mile of the theater, and here was a big pileup on the highway. I said, that's great. The night that we have a movie, there's an accident. We were the accident. These were, in one day, the word of mouth became strong enough that cars were backed up to get into that theater. And you should have seen the caliber of moviegoer in those cars.
Wow.
It looked like a bottom-end mafia convention. And here were six people in the car and two more people hidden in the trunk. But the odd thing about our type of movie at that time, it killed the concession stand. Today, it's exactly the reverse. That really might help explain the evolution, or maybe devolution, of society itself.
Yes.
That today, when you show a movie of this type, which we now call splatter films, we just call it gory movies, the concession stand goes over the top. We'll figure that out. Well, anyway, Blood Feast was an absolute smash from the moment it opened up. And very quickly, it was all over the industry. And I said to Dave, what if we made a decent one? Because with Blood Feast, we shaved everywhere we could. Not just on the raw stock and the processing, but on the effects. We were using department store mannequins just stuffed with glop. That was our effect. We were safe in that case because no one had ever done this before. So I'm quoted many times as comparing Blood Feast to a Walt Whitman poem. It was no good, but it was the first of its type. And I still maintain that. It was no good, but it was the first of its type. There's a benefit. There is a posture in being the first. Say of Columbus. He left not knowing where he was going. He got there and didn't know where it was. He came back and didn't know where he had been, but he was the first. And that also explains Blood Feast. So based on the instant success of Blood Feast, which left us both breathless, here was a new genre of motion picture. And we were kings. We were the only people, in fact, in the kingdom. So that's when the idea came up for 2000 Maniacs. I've seen in print and a number of sources that the inspiration for 2000 Maniacs was a movie called Brigadoon, which is a little town in either England or Ireland someplace that comes back to life every 100 years. That is not the case. No, Brigadoon didn't exist when we made 2000 Maniacs. Now, it doesn't bother me that someone draws that conclusion. I don't like to be a follower, but at least not anymore. We shot 2,000 Maniacs in a little town called St. Cloud, Florida. Now, St. Cloud is right on the edge of the Disney Empire in Orlando. Of course, Disney didn't exist then either. Once again, we had the entire area to ourselves. And when someone said, what are you shooting? We'd say, well, we're here to shoot an orange juice commercial. But once the people in St. Cloud found out what we were actually doing, they all pitched in. Everybody almost who lived in St. Cloud is in that movie as an extra.
Wow.
And everybody had a rollicking good time. That's one of my tenets of making movies. Right. Everybody has to have a good time.
Right.
There's nothing deadly serious about it. It's not life-threatening. It's something that people should enjoy doing or get another profession, which I've been told to do often enough. Well, once we had 2,000 Maniacs out there, the benefit of 2,000 Maniacs, which to this day is my favorite of all the movies I've made, we were in solid position. One anecdote about 2,000 Maniacs, which again has floated through the industry for years and years, when as I think you're aware, it's my voice on the theme song of 2000 Maniacs,
yeah,
which I wrote. And I didn't write this because I wanted to be an auteur. I just didn't want to pay anybody. Many of the innovations or the credit I'm getting for innovating were simply the result of not wanting to pay somebody else when I knew I could do it myself. Perhaps not as professionally, but certainly for a lot less money.
Right.
So I wrote the theme for 2000 Maniacs. We had three musicians, two guitars and a banjo. And these fellows were marvelous musicians. They were exceptional. But the problem came when we were going to record the theme. And as I think, again, you're aware, in 2000 Maniacs, there's a rebel yell. Yeehaw!
Right.
And I wanted the entire cast and the entire crew in a little recording studio in Orlando to do the yeehaw. And this was at the end of a particularly difficult shooting day.
Right.
And they wanted to get away and let's have dinner. Come on, long enough. So the musical group was there, and it turned out their lead singer was a high tenor. And listening to this, I said, this won't work. It's just not macho. That's the way it's supposed to be. It opens, as I, again, I'm quoting things that I know you're aware of. I don't know about your listeners. If they had any smarts, they wouldn't be listening to me. There's a story you should know from 100 years ago. Well, what was I going to do? I had to get this thing recorded. Since I had written it, I certainly knew the tempo. And
right.
My voice was deep enough. I'll do it myself. So it's my voice with no screen credits. I don't think, if you look at the credits for 2000 Maniacs, you won't see that it's my voice on that track. But again, the movie business is a very incestuous business. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And word got out, and to this day, again, if I go to one of these film festivals, I'll get asked, would you sing the theme from 2000 Maniacs? You bet I will. Well, 2000 Maniacs never quite did the business Blood Feast did. In fact, the only movie I ever made that came close to Blood Feast in terms of total box office gross was She-Devils on Wheels, my female motorcycle gang movie, some years later. But 2000 Maniacs said to the industry, hey, these guys actually can make a movie. And what 2000 Maniacs did was open some playing time in theaters that otherwise might not have played our kind of movie. Because, first of all, the effects were not as vicious as they are in Blood Feast. I went back to that later on, though, because that's where the guaranteed audience was. And second, it really did have a little bit of production value. And some of the actors in there I used later on in other movies because they had a talent was a factor, too. They
right.
became the character they were representing in the movie. Well, with that underway, what happened was there was an exhibitor in Chicago named Stan
right.
Kohlberg, who owned a bunch of theaters in and around Chicago. And he owned the Bel Air Drive-In in Peoria, where we opened Blood Feast. Now, Kohlberg smelled blood. I knew that he had a dicey reputation. At the time, I didn't care that much because I was still in the golden glow of suddenly having a successful business venture. So Kohlberg said, if you guys want to form a permanent production company, I will get the Exchange Bank here in Chicago to fund that company. Now, who would say no to a deal like that? Kohlberg, meanwhile, had invested in the third movie, which was Color Me Blood Red, about a mad painter, and he'll get the right color red, he has to use human blood. Obviously, there's no logic there either.
I was going to say, it's turned blue.
wouldn't have happened. And we agreed also, because here was a deal that nobody could say no to, it's like Mario Puzo, an offer we couldn't refuse, that the monies from Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs would go into a common pot with Color Me Blood Red, so we could show a decent return to the Exchange Bank. Well, a month went by, 2 months went by, and nothing happened. And almost accidentally, I ran into a fellow named Ted Mellon, who was an officer at the Exchange Bank, whom I knew. I said, hey, whatever happened, where's our deal here on the production company? He said, oh, there's no deal. Kohlberg called that off about a month ago. To which we said, uh-oh. It turned out we had a fourth partner whose name was Sid Reach, R-E-I-C-E-H. Sid Reach owned a company in Rochester, New York called Burns-O-Matic that made them, they may still be in business. They made blow torches and paint, and of some means, a legitimate business, which had no reason to be in the movie business. So we got into a big squabble, and Sid Reach, Dave, and I all sued Kohlberg. And at that point, I said to Dave, I said, hey, we have to have some income. The wheels of justice in Chicago not only grind slowly, they sometimes don't grind at all, depending on who has clout. I said, it could be years before we had any resolution here. We better get ourselves a movie. And that's when I began to plan what became Moonshine Mountain, because we had a distributor in Charlotte, North Carolina, who controlled three of the exchange areas, Charlotte, Atlanta, and Jacksonville. At that time, there were, I think, 26 exchange areas in the United States. And Harry Kerr, who owned that company, said to me, if you'll make a movie on the order of Thunder Road, I can pretty much guarantee you a big playoff. Well, heck yeah, I'll make a movie on the order of whatever you want me to make a movie on the order of. We can get it played. So off I went to North and South Carolina. We actually shot this in a town called Bullock Creek, South Carolina, and began preparation for Moonshine Mountain. Suddenly, Dave Friedman disappeared. I said, uh-oh. I called him at home. His phone had been disconnected. I had no way of reaching Dave Friedman at all. Really, it was close to a month afterward that I got the word that he had settled independently with Kohlberg and moved to California. And those were lean times, because I had felt at the time that Dave and I were locked together for whatever might happen. Meanwhile, to complete the fiasco, Sid Reach died. His children wanted no part of this deal at all. Whether they ever settled with Kohlberg, I'll never know, because Kohlberg is long since dead now, too. But here I am, left alone, trying to pursue this thing, and I did not have enough money to have the kind of competent legal counsel I should have had. Crapola. Well, I better finish Moonshine Mountain. Harry Kerr, who was my distributor in Charlotte, said, don't worry about it. He says, I'll give you an advance. And he did. He became forever in my book of gold for that. I shot Moonshine Mountain with no partners at all. Moonshine Mountain, of course, I had to pull the horns way in to be able to finish that movie with the amount of money I had to make it with. And yet, Moonshine Mountain literally supported me for 2 years. That wow. One movie, an indication of the ups and downs of the movie business. So eventually, I got a hearing with a judge in Chicago, whose name, Judge Marovitz, it was Abraham Lincoln Marovitz. And this guy was a total nut on Abraham Lincoln. His office had nothing but Lincoln memorabilia in it. It was very strange. But the problem I had with Judge Abraham Lincoln Marovitz, he was a close friend of Stan Kohlberg. And we had a meeting in the judge's chambers, and he said, I can't believe this, he says to Kohlberg, a classy guy like you. And at that point, I said to myself, uh-oh. So about 2 years after this whole thing began, settled with Kohlberg for a nominal amount of money, figuring I'm just lucky to get out of this alive because I didn't want to pay any more legal fees, which, again, is an indication of Chicago politics. What the heck? Well, by that time, of course, the die was cast, and I was pretty much determined that if I was going to have any kind of sanity in my life, I had better exploit another area of income that I had developed, was advertising. I had originally formed a little advertising agency primarily to handle movie advertising, because once the word got out about how our movies were making money, other producers were giving me their films to do the campaigns. For an independent at the time, the campaign was pretty much a press book, which was a bunch of ads, a synopsis written in a highly positive manner, and maybe continuity for radio commercials, that kind of thing, which was not much of a challenge, but it certainly was an income producer. And from that, I spread out to get a lot of mail order advertising and that kind of thing. I shifted gradually into that direction.
Now, that was one heck of an answer.
I've written a book to give you an answer. My apology for that, by the way. I shouldn't be so verbose.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Marsha Gordon Lewis. Coming up, we actually begin an interview with Karen Black and the footage putting views on unions and Herschel Striker. It's only here on Third Eye Cinema.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, one of the homes for highbrow interview entertainment.
So my next question is actually going to dial it way back, because I've got some things to touch on that you sort of touched on along the way. You rather famously pitched that first film that you were doing to Dave Freeman and some other investors by saying, I want to make a film that'll make money. I mean, no auteur's pretensions there. That's a pretty direct comment. And the film that resulted was obviously The Prime Time, and you had a young Karen Black in there.
Yes,
now,
we did.
Tell us about the whole issue with Karen Black's nude footage.
I would. That's a wonderful question. Karen Black, as it turned out, was a student at Northwestern University, which
right.
is also where I went to school. She was the girlfriend of a fellow named Bill Ehrman, and Bill Ehrman was the brother of Dick Ehrman, who was my close friend, who was an investor in Mid-Continent Films. That's how Karen Black got into that movie.
Right.
Dick Ehrman said to me, my brother's going with the girl. You can make him a big hero by putting her in the movie. And what did I care? Girl's a girl. And that's how Karen Black was in that movie. As I remember, she was not that easy to work with because Bill apparently had pumped her full of gas about what a major talent she was.
Right.
I remember that her fingernails needed a lot of work, either from having been bitten or chewed or knocked off or whatever, but
right.
that wasn't a factor in the kind of role she had. We had, at the time, decided to make two versions of The Prime Time. Dave had an informational aspect here that there was a separate way we could make movies for the European market, and the European market would accept bare breasts where the American market wouldn't. So we would have two versions of this movie, and Karen Black was supposed to be in the European version. When we came to shoot that thing in somebody's quarry that had water in it, suddenly here came Bill Ehrman saying, no, you can't do that. Karen has too big a future. We can't do that. And I had to reschedule the entire thing because of that.
Wow.
And that's when I said, okay, Karen Black, you've had your moment in the sun with me and I with you. But I cannot have that kind of activity or lack of it in one of my movies. But, yes, it was her first movie.
So was it true that the guy actually had paid you like half a day's shooting money to destroy the footage, or was there no footage in the first place?
There was no footage in the first place. I shouldn't say that. We had begun to expose some film, to expose Karen Black's epidermis. And I don't know that it was anything of consequence. But, yes, Bill was so enamored of this girl that I was later on saying to myself, why didn't I demand some ransom money here?
Yeah, as you mentioned, you chose not to direct or write the screenplay on this first one, so it's really nothing like a Herschel Gordon Lewis film in any real respect. You know, it's
not
a fairly dry JD film with an anti-beatnik bent.
See, again, I listen to too many people. One advantage I have today is occasionally somebody will listen to me. But at the time, here's this tyro coming in with no background in feature films at all. And I welcomed almost any advice I could get from anyone who might claim expertise in any facet filmmaking. And that's how that happened. But as you point out just now, it was not, it's my first movie, but it was not my movie.
And you actually ran a contest in a local newspaper for, I believe it was $50, to get a title for the film. I'm assuming this was just a promotional stunt? Or
that's all it
actually
was promotional. There was a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times named Herb Kupcinet. In fact, we talk about putting his daughter in the movie, but it became an impossible negotiation. was done with his cooperation in his column to try to build a little hype. That shows how little I knew. Who the heck cared about what would go on in Chicago months before a movie was ready? Who would even remember any of this stuff?
Tell us a little about Carving Magic with Bill Kerwin and Harvey Korman, because this little industrial film actually led to your first directorial credit and what most consider to be the first true Herschel Gordon Lewis film, which was Living Venus.
Well, yes and no. Yeah, Harvey Korman was a stage actor in Chicago. Very talented guy, by the way. Although later on, he became Hollywoodish, which was something of a turnoff. But this was nothing I owned. I was paid to make this thing. And it was, I wouldn't call it a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie, only because it was done to order with materials and script and plot line, if you want to call it a plot line, that were
right.
Pre-supplied by whoever paid for that thing.
Well, I'm actually glad to hear that, because while the story did work, you know, it was competent and fairly commercial, it was really kind of dry and boring. I mean, it had that
yep.
grim, moralistic rise and fall that films did at the time, basically so that prudes could get their prurient fix, while at the same time they're being made to feel safe and superior by having the naughty behavior frowned upon and punished at the end. And my wife particularly hated this one. Of all the films that I showed her of yours, and she really despised this one. And I understand that, because, you know, I didn't care for all that kind of conservative moralizing myself.
Or did I? I admire your wife for her astuteness here. She's quite right. But you've got to realize the temper of the time. Somebody was paying to have something done.
Yeah, because we were both very glad that you shifted focus to exploitation after that. But if you were just getting paid because of a work-for-hire job...
That's all it was. Absolutely. I was a hired Hessian.
So one thing that interested me is that you said at one point that your films had to work because they were either self-financed or involved what you refer to as hard-boiled partners, with, you know, kind of the implication that either way you're continuing to go on not only as a filmmaker but maybe in good health as well, sort of boiled down to you're making a good profit on each one.
Well, I have often maintained, to the consternation of a lot of filmmakers, it's a business. We call it the movie business, and yet many people in it don't, they say that. They give it a little lip service, but they don't believe it as they say it. They want to give birth, and you make a comment about something in their movie, and it's as though you're attacking their child. Oh, my God, you know how would I put it? It's a business, and there are only two kinds of movies on this planet, those that make money and those that don't. Anybody keeps score a different way, I'm delighted to have him or her as a competitor.
So I understand one major reason you were able to make so many successful films is that, number one, you filmed most of them non-union, which may have also played into why you had to more or less vacate Chicago for Florida for the bulk of your productions.
Well, as I think, again, you're aware, because Fred Niles was a union studio. I shot The Prime Time, and I shot Living Venus with an IA crew. IA stands for International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. IATSE, they sometimes call it. And I had Screen Actors Guild involved in the for the actors. And the money that was wasted and lost was appalling. Now, when I first started that, I figured that's the way you made movies. But then I began to realize the crew goes into overtime at 5:30 p.m. Try to get an assistant cameraman to load a magazine at 5:25. Can't be done. And a whole bunch of episodes of that type led me to believe, what's the benefit? I'm not going to get better playing time because of it. All it means is I'm going to spend more money for the same movie. And I had no problem getting actors once we got past The Prime Time and Living Venus. They were all over me. Put me in a movie. So Screen Actors Guild wasn't a factor. In fact, as a matter of fact, when we first started shooting, I joined Screen Actors Guild. And later, just let it lapse because there was no benefit there. And I got into a big squabble with the union steward for the stagehands in Chicago. I said, that's all I need now. Forget it. And so it wasn't a matter of shooting in Chicago or shooting in Florida or shooting in California, where I made a few movies, by the way. It was simply a matter of not wanting to have that albatross around my neck, which added nothing to production and added a great deal to cost.
I was given to understand that Chicago is a very strong union town, so I had the impression that that was why you went to Florida, because, you know, maybe you can get around the...
Oh, sure. Florida's a right-to-work state.
right.
not as much right to work as it used to be, because once word got out down here of what we were doing, it was the Teamsters that jumped all over me. But I simply was able to successfully resist this until the movie was finished shooting. And I, again, I'm probably regarded as an outlaw in some quarters of that type. But my opinion is, you may regard it as heartless. I regard it as logical. If I'm paying for something, I want something equivalent to what I'm paying for. And that's the reason I've been making movies of the type I've made.
So what do you think sets your films apart beyond the obvious exploitation elements, be they nudity, roughy, gore, biker, hillbilly? Because I instantly pick up on the comedy and your wry sense of humor about the whole thing. It's like a sort of metatextual sarcasm, but in an endearing sense, not like the snarkiness of today.
Well, you just thrust home with your entire comment there. First of all, I believe there should be at least one scene in each movie that has people going out of the theater not saying, "What a crappy production," saying, "Hey, did you see that?" Whatever it was. In the case of Blood Feast, it was the tongue scene. There's got to be something in there that is a grabber. Second, I want whoever shows this movie theatrically, which is increasingly difficult to do, by the way, to say, "I can make a little money on this movie." Example, in comes a major company movie, and the production company says to the theater, "Here's our deal. First week, we get 90%, you get 10%. Second week, 80-20. Third and fourth week, 60-40 our way. And from that point beyond, it's 50-50. A theater can say yes or no, but now in today's marketplace, where a theater may have a dozen separate screens, they're more likely to say yes than say no. I come in with some schmucky little picture. They hold it right there. Book us for a week. If you like it, we'll hold a second week. We want 35%, you get 65%. The theater says, "Hey, if I do half the business, I will make more money from it." And you see, our approach, our sales argument becomes a sales argument. Not right. We have Brad Pitt or George Clooney in this movie, which right. I'm never going to have. It's that the theater can make money. Now we have another problem today, and that is that the amount of playing time is drying up because theaters are now booking movies months ahead. Some of them now, in April, are booking movies for August. So here comes somebody with, "What? Oh, I haven't got any open screens." So movies are going directly to DVD. Can you make any money going directly to DVD? Probably not. In fact, that's my big argument with the distribution of my new movie called The Uh-Oh Show. I did. See, you're never beyond making mistakes. I made a mistake. And I made a mistake because I wanted to make this movie. And the deal I made was that I would direct it. I wrote it and I directed it. But I was excluded from the deals in distribution. I wish I hadn't done that. On the other hand, if I had insisted on being involved in distribution, the deal might not have come together at all.
Right.
I was dealing with some hard-boiled people here. So what decision did I make? I said, "Let's make the movie." They, in turn, got into a distribution situation here, which is just taking form, to which I absolutely object. And I'm certainly at a point now where I have no problem whatever voicing my objections. My days of naivete are long gone. But had I been involved in distribution, they would not have made a deal that they did to go to a company that really plans to have it straight to DVD.
Before we go any further, tell us a bit about some of your, quote, regulars. First and most obviously, Bill Kerwin. He'd actually been doing TV and bit parts since 1952 until you cast him for the industrial film Carving Magic. And then you used him and Harvey for Living Venus before he wound up starring in a large portion of your films thereafter.
Yeah, Bill became almost my stock hero. Good-natured guy, good-looking guy, totally good. He was a pitch-in type who would help pick up the stuff at the end of a day's shooting. Bill had two problems. One was he was a heavy smoker. Always tried to introduce a cigarette into some of his scenes. And in my objection to having take two, I sometimes let it go by, even though he and I had sometimes had harsh words about that. But he was always on the set on time. Now, people talk about drinkers who just don't show up, or they're found wandering the streets in the middle of the night saying, "Who am I and where am I?" Bill was a pretty good drinker, tippler, but he never, never let it show on the screen. So I began to have great faith in Bill Kerwin's ability to perform on cue. He knew his line. And because Bill was a member of Screen Actors Guild, eventually he used the name Thomas Wood. And on one movie, he used the name Rooney, R-O-O-N-E-Y, Rooney Kerwin. I didn't care what he wanted to be called. But, yeah, he became part of the permanent stock company.
He's also been involved in a number of other cult oddities besides your films, like things like Pagan Island, My Third Wife George, Dear Dead Delilah. I mean, he was all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. And he and his brother Harry made a couple of movies on their own.
So it was going to be like God's Blood Acre, Barracuda.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's actually such a prominent and entertaining persona on screen in your films and these other ones. In addition to all his acting roles, he actually wrote Living Venus. Is that true?
No, he didn't write Living Venus. Jim McGinn wrote Living Venus.
Okay, because they gave him a credit for that.
I think so. It's been a while since I saw that movie, but I don't think you'll see Bill Kerwin given any credit for screenwriting. No, a fellow named Jim McGinn wrote Living Venus. It turned out that Jim McGinn, who was a scriptwriter, was a personal friend of Hugh Hefner. That may be why this thing took the form it did.
Wow.
We had a number of conversations on that score.
Yeah, this was off of, I believe, IMDb, because they give him credit for writing that, which is obviously not true. And some other oddities, like there's a few nudies, like Adam Lost His Apple and Sweet Bird of Aquarius, Love Goddess is a Blood Island, and Sting of Death, along with the jellyfish guy. So I thought that was rather odd.
Yeah, but those were not my movies.
No, there were others. Tell us a bit about Allison Louise Down, who's also known as Vicki Miles.
Louise Down, who also used the name Vicki Miles. I met her through a fellow named K. Gordon Murray. Way, way back, there was a television comedian named Ken Murray who had a television show that was very well thought of. Unluckily for K. Gordon Murray, his real name was Ken Murray. He couldn't use it because the other Ken Murray had pretty much usurped the promotional value of the name. He had used Louise Down in a couple of movies, both as an actress and as a production assistant. And the benefit that she brought to the mix was she knew everybody in that sleazy aspect of movie making in the Miami area. So she became a valuable asset in that regard. And I would use Louise Down, first of all, to get other girls when we shot that kind of a movie, help cast when we made another movie. In fact, on some occasions, because we had no script for Blood Feast, we would give her credit for writing the script, which she obviously didn't do. Later on, she used that as ammunition trying to get other screenwriting jobs. I don't know if she ever did get one. She came back to Chicago to work for me on I thought it might be on a semi-permanent basis, but I lost touch with her. She became enamored of a used car dealer or something like that, and I lost track of her.
Yeah, that actually touched on two things I was going to mention, because even beyond yours, she was involved in some nudies for Doris Wishman and Barry Mann.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if credits are to be believed, which you're already indicating may not be the case, she had credits for being assistant director on a couple of your films,
mm-hmm.
writer on a couple of others, and the one that really made me laugh was special effects on Wizard of Gore and Gorgor Girls. So is any of that true?
Yes, it is. Yeah, she developed a moderate talent in being able to smear people up with our glop. Yes, that is true.
But did she actually write any of your films?
She was not a screenwriter, but we had no problem giving out screen credits. Oftentimes, in fact, that would be the case, not necessarily with her, but with a lot of people, including Bill Kerwin, where we say, we can't pay you any more money, but we'll give you a full screen credit.
Wow.
And an actor recognizes the not just the emotional value, but the dollar value of that.
Tell us a little bit about Nancy Lee Noble, the cute, perky redhead who starred in a number of your later films.
Well,
before
Nancy
going
Lee
on
Noble
to...
was our ingenue. Again, a sweet little kid. In fact, when we shot She-Devils on Wheels, Nancy Lee Noble had to learn how to ride a little Honda 50 motorcycle, which barely qualifies, by the way, as a motorcycle. It's more of a moped than a motorcycle. Very cooperative. She was also in The Pill, which we had to retitle. It was a movie was called The Pill, but as it turned out, somebody else also had a movie titled The Pill, and I didn't want to get into some legal battle over who has the name The Pill. We changed it to The Girl, The Boy, and The Pill, and somehow or other, in the typesetting or whatever, it came out The Girl, The Body, and The Pill. Girl, The Boy, and The Pill. We just left it.
She also was in Just for the Hell of It, I believe, before she went on to things like Medium Cool and Jackson County Jail for Roger Corman before disappearing from the film world. You're listening to Third
Jeff Simon with our special guest tonight, Russia Gordon Lewis. Coming up, we discuss Blood Feast, 2000 Maniacs, Connie Mason, Moonshine Mountain, Bill Rebane, and Monster of Vampire, and there's a third eye film. Career. You actually started off by pretty much inaugurating the nudie cutie genre, often working with, you know, dim Playboy models and hard-bitten strippers like Rusty Allen and the positively frightening Virginia Bell. Tell us about some of the difficulties involved there.
Well, Virginia Bell, who had the stage presence called Virginia Ding Dong Bell, at the time when I was making these movies, as I told you earlier, we began to make the same kind of movies for other people. A lot of them were theater owners like Tom Dowd, who could offer something we couldn't. Tom Dowd would say to somebody, "I'll play your picture if you'll play mine." And since he owned a key theatrical outlet, that was a major factor. Well, there was a fellow in Miami named Leroy Griffith who owned a theater of this type in Miami. He had as a partner a fellow in Cincinnati named Eli Jackson, who owned a theater in Cincinnati. And we agreed to make a movie for them. They as partners. And this movie was starring Eli Jackson's wife, who was Virginia Bell. Now, Virginia Bell peaked period before the silicone implants became a factor. She had a natural bosom, which was awesome. The joke we had around the set was, "Don't let her fall on you. You'll smother." And that was her talent, as far as we knew, that she had a huge bosom. And she was a star of burlesque or something of the sort. We didn't care, because Eli and Leroy were paying for this movie. That, in fact, was the genesis of Blood Feast, in a sense, because we were down in Miami shooting this movie for Eli Jackson and Leroy Griffith, and it took only about 4 days, which was our typical shooting time anyway. And it was cold in Chicago. I said, "Hey, well, while we're here, let's shoot one for us." And that's when I was watching television late at night and got the idea for Blood Feast. See, everything was very casual, and casual sometimes can expand to casualty, but in this case, that was Virginia Bell's epic, the Bell, Bear, and Beautiful.
You know, that must have been pretty difficult working with people like that because, you know, as you can tell, they're kind of dim, a lot of these girls that you were using in the nudies.
Yeah, but so what? Really, so what?
But it must be hard to give them direction, get them to do whatever you want them to do.
Well, the directions were as primitive as the film itself. That's not why people go to see these movies. They don't go to see the earth exploding or a bunch of cars catching fire as they go down the street mowing down rows and rows of other cars. That's not our kind of movie.
My favorite of your nudies is actually Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Bill Kerwin is quite fearless about acting in the nude, and his comedy routines are actually pretty amusing.
Mm-hmm. I say he was a totally cooperative guy on the set, no matter what the movie was. And I like people whose ego doesn't take charge.
We'd mentioned Doris Wishman earlier. It's a little-known fact that she actually starred in one of your nudies, Nature's Playmates, as one of the nudists, correct?
No, that's not so. I've heard that many times. No, Doris was a contemporary, but she was never in one of my movies.
Okay.
In fact, we never really crossed paths until many, many years later, when she was very close to disappearing altogether from the face of the earth. Now, Doris, if she was, I wasn't aware of it.
Well, it said that she used
You've got more information there than I have. Do you see her name listed in the screen credits?
Well, it said that she used the pseudonym of Doris Wisher as opposed to Wishman.
All things are possible. If that's the case, that's the first I've heard in all these years. Then I did not recognize her as herself at the time, nor did she.
That's probably not true, then.
As herself. She made a movie called Nude on the Moon, and that was all I really knew about Doris Wishman until some years later, when I don't even remember how it was that we wound up being interviewed jointly, which I thought was a real joke, and she said in front of everybody there, she said to me, you and I have to make a movie together. By that time, both of us would not have looked all that good on screen.
So what led you to move out of the nudie genre so quickly? Because you actually made some of the best of the genre alongside Wishman and Barry Mayen, but after producing a mere handful, you shifted right over to the gore film of Blood Feast.
Well, I began to realize that this film, this field, was becoming too crowded.
Right.
You see, you don't wait until you're shoved off the edge before you make a decision. That
sure.
has been, in fact, my pattern, and I take great pride in that, in trying to anticipate what's next, not
right.
just following what's next. And that's why when we shot the Uh-Oh Show, I felt, as I feel very strongly as we speak this moment, the time has come to have this type of splatter movie, we'll call it, cease being derivative, where people think it's the same movie they saw before. You look at the Screams and the Houses on Elm Street and the Amityville Horrors, you say, yeah, here it is again. You don't say that about the Uh-Oh Show, because the Uh-Oh Show, in my opinion, and all it is an opinion, welds together the standard slasher movie with the non-standard wild joke. When we cut somebody apart, that person doesn't die of shock and loss of blood. That person's irritated. And the audience knows immediately the whole thing is a gag.
Right.
I feel it's time to move in that direction. Now, whether I'm right or wrong, that's the conclusion I came to. But I don't want to make the same movie everybody else is making.
So, as you'd mentioned, you used most of the entire cast of Belle, Bear, and Beautiful to make Blood Feast.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Mal Arnold, who played the inimitable, limping, oddly eyebrow caterer Fuad Ramses, as you've mentioned, was actually a veteran of Goldilocks and the Three Bears and mm-hmm. was in Scum of the Earth. And he starred in one last nudie, Adam Lost His Apple, before vanishing from the film world. So beyond what you already mentioned earlier, tell us a little bit about him and what inspired his unusual performance there.
Well, Mal Arnold, again, appealed to me because he was cooperative. See, that's a factor. When you're making
right.
a low-budget movie, you certainly don't need somebody's ego dominating the situation. And so I felt that he was our kind of guy. And it made no difference what kind of role he had, just
right.
as some years later when I was shooting The Wizard of Gore.
Right.
And my partner was a fellow named Fred Sandy. And Fred got into an argument with the actor who was going to play the wizard. This fellow said, well, what, you guys are paying me? Screw this. And he walked off the set. We were shooting in the lobby of a building in Chicago, and he stood outside the building waiting for somebody to come get him. Well, I couldn't do that. Fred was wrong, but he was my partner. Ray Sager was working on the crew for The Wizard of Gore.
Right.
I said, hey, Ray, you want to be Montag the Magician? Yeah, sure. that's called casual casting. I recommend it because you can sure beat budgetary problems that way.
I was wondering if there's any thought or rationale behind him doing the arched eyebrows and the really over-the-top performance he did with the limping and dragging the foot behind him. And, it's not your standard, okay, here's a killer running around chasing someone. He's kind of limping along and making goofy faces. And
that's the idea. I wanted to make him as odd a character as I possibly could, which I felt made him a little more threatening than usual.
Tell us a little about your issues with Connie Mason, the Playboy playmate who starred in Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs, because I understand you had a rather difficult time with her.
Well, only because there were two things about Connie Mason. One is she had a terrible time trying to learn lines. It was beyond her. We called her Friedman's Folly. Dave found her, I think, in the Miami Playboy Club. There's no question that she was decorative.
Oh, yeah.
There's no question either that she slowed down production to a point where when we used her a second time, which was her last appearance for us in 2000 Maniacs, we gave a number of her lines to other people in the cast because it just would have taken us forever to get them shot. She also, by the way, in one scene was driving a convertible that we had used in the movie, and she drove it right into the side of a wall or something, and we had a several hundred dollar repair bill, which did not endear her to my heart. I made a remark, which I guess regrettably or otherwise appeared in print all over the place, about Connie Mason, and that was, if they ever took the key out of her back, she would simply stand in place. And I guess I didn't endear myself to her with that. A couple of years ago, somehow or other, when I attended one of these horror film festivals, who was there but Connie Mason? And they had me in a question and answer session. She marched up onto the stage, pulled up a chair to sit next to me, and began to answer questions in a very strange way, I felt. She kept saying, well, here's what happened at Heff's house. So the whoever was running this thing said, what's a Heff's house? Which made him my hero for the moment. Well, you know, Heff, the guy who runs Playboy. She meant Hugh Hefner.
Right.
She had a show. She was part of the in-group by referring to Heff's house. Now, whatever happened to Connie's later career, I don't know. But for me, she was in two movies, and we did certainly we exploited her because she was Playmate of the Year one year, which doesn't have anything to do with talent, by the way, at least not thespian talent.
So, Blood Feast, tell us about the aftermath of the pizza parlor shoot where you both melted the street and then wound up terrifying the pizza maker with the arm in the oven.
Well, what happened there, this was in Blood Feast, where we were trying to show Fuad Ramsey's cooking a body part. And we threw it out, and it turned out onto the asphalt street. It literally melted the asphalt in the street. The curiosity of movie making.
Right. But you also had left some body parts there and apparently scared somebody that was working at the pizza parlor?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, that was a standard thing for us anyway. People were always astounded at what we would shoot when we were making an orange juice commercial.
Outside of what you were doing, there was really only two other gore films. The recently discovered short Fall in That Skirt, and J.G. Patterson, who was in Your Moonshine Mountain, he made The Body Shot. That was basically it in the U.S. in terms of gore films until the slasher boom in the late 70s. So why do you think that is? What do you think the appeal was and why people were really avoiding that?
I don't think they were avoiding it. I don't think that what really happened was they didn't realize how easy it was to do this. Pat Patterson was an assistant of Harry Kerr, the distributor in Charlotte, North Carolina. He made a movie, I think, also called Dr. Gore, which
that's the
you
same
may or
film.
May not have access to.
Yeah, the body
I don't know whether
became,
it ever appeared anywhere or not. But the I was very pleased that it took the industry so long to recognize what was going on.
Yeah, Dr. Gore actually is The Body Shop. They renamed it or retitled it for exploitation value, obviously. You handled all the music from Blood Feast with its enamel organ and timpani score, and you scored at least part of 2000 Maniacs with the Hillbilly Country. And I've got to say, the first time I, and it was actually my drummer from my old band, had seen the film back in the late 80s, that title track became an instant favorite. And, you know, you started singing it before. It's like, I can probably still sing part of the lyrics to this day, the opening to 2000 Maniacs. It was just such a great song. Did you actually write the song itself, or was
certainly
it just...
Certainly I did. You shouldn't be astounded at that. In the case of Blood Feast, that was a little more difficult. What happened then, because that was early in the cycle, and I wanted an original soundtrack, an original music track.
Right.
And I was getting estimates to score that movie that were more than the movie cost to make. I said, what the f*** is this all about? That's when I decided to do it myself. Now, I'd had some background in music, not enough to really qualify as a composer on the level of Shostakovich, but certainly enough that I could recognize a musical note when I saw one.
Right.
And so I knew what I wanted. I wanted odd sounds. I wanted a trombone. I wanted a cello that I could get weird music from.
Right.
I wanted kettle drums,
right.
And I wanted just an organ to flesh out the chords in between. Now, I grant you that's somewhat Spartan as a musical score for a movie, but that
right.
was enough for what I wanted.
Oh,
I was not about to pay somebody more than the movie cost to make to score that movie. I've never worked so hard in my life. I will also tell you, the feeling of accomplishment when you record the music and it comes out the way you intended it to, that beats almost anything. But this is another anecdote relative to that, which I didn't think much about it at the time. But
right.
in later years, it became a joking point. I found a cello player who really, I could have whistled and he played it. That's how good he was. I had a trombonist who could make that instrument stand on its ear. I had Larry Wellington, with whom I'd worked a number of times elsewhere, doing the organ chords. And I rented kettle drums from Frank's Drum Shop in Chicago. And I later on began to wonder whether I deliberately had not hired a kettle drum player. But I didn't. And I kept thinking to myself, this is how you become delusional, that I was going to get a kettle drum player, but I never did. And I wound up playing the kettle drums myself in that Blood Feast scoring. Later years, I found out the great conductor Leopold Stokowski played no instrument, and to get him into the Musicians Union, they qualified him on the kettle drum. So I began to say, well, my buddy Leo and I played the same instrument.
You had made, after 2000 Maniacs, which again was great, I remember, again, the same year we were talking about my drummer there, used to walk around doing Mayor Buckman impressions for years on end, but you made somewhat of the same story with a bit less of the Gru in Moonshine Mountain in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And while I like both, 2000 Maniacs did have a better script, feel, and acting, if you can say that with a straight face. The town seemed rather odd and run down, making the location a character all by itself. Forget the actors. This was actually Kissimmee St. Cloud, which shortly thereafter became the home of Disney World, as you mentioned. So do you think they used that in their tours? And here's where Herschel Gordon Lewis filmed the barrel roll in 2000.
I should demand royalties. No, I think they probably spent a lot of time and effort denying it. No, it wasn't on this planet.
What was the story with Bill Rabane and Terror at Half Day, which you had cobbled together with new footage of a whole lot of dancing, basically, as Monster a Go-Go?
Well, what happened there was typical of the movie industry at that time. To get playing time in a drive-in theater, you had a choice. A drive-in theater would usually play two movies of an evening. One was regarded as first feature, the other was regarded as second feature. Now, from the viewpoint of the movie business as a business, first feature got a percentage. Second feature would go in on a flat fee. So they'd say to the movie that had the percentage, all right, your deal is you get 35%, you get 25%, you get 50%, whatever that was. It was a percent of box office gross. Second movie, say, we'll pay you $50 flat for the week. So obviously the second feature did not have the position first feature had. Some drive-ins began to use that as weaponry. They would say to the owners of both films, well, you're going in the second feature, so we can only pay you $50, $100 flat for the week. The other feature is getting first position. I realized that and said if I owned both sides, they could not say that. They couldn't say that both movies were going in flat because it would be obvious that I owned them both. So I had to have a second half for Moonshine Mountain. There was a movie out there I think Paramount had made called Little Abner, which was on the market for a while, and they took that off, and I needed a second half. What was I going to get? And Bill Rabane had made this movie called Terror at Half Day, which I felt was an impossible title. Half Day is a little town about 40 miles northwest of Chicago. But who knows that? What does it mean, Terror at Half Day? It starred an old vaudeville guy named Henry Hight. And this goes way, way back in time, or Henry Hight did. There was a vaudeville act called Low, Hight, and Stanley. Low was a midget. Height was regarded as the tallest man on the earth, and Stanley was an ordinary guy. And as sometimes happens in show business, Stanley disappeared, and right. The act fell apart, and Stanley was certainly the most replaceable part right. Of the act. So Henry Height was living in a little hotel on Rush Street, somewhat down on his luck. Bill Rabane put him in this movie. I was somewhat familiar with Terror at Half Day because for one sequence, Bill Rabane had hired me and my crew to shoot one of these sequences for Terror at Half Day. I couldn't, from what I had shot, make any sense out of it, but I knew that mine was a peripheral scene that I had shot for that movie. Later on, the movie became available. It was shot in black and white, which didn't appeal to me. The laboratory picked up this movie and said, do you want it? We've got 80,000 feet of film here. Imagine shooting 80,000 feet of film
for
a movie of that type. And I made a deal to pick up the footage, which I would use as a second half with Moonshine Mountain. It turned out there's some very odd things in Terror at Half Day. One was that they had an army officer, and they, I guess, had rented a uniform. And Bill shot this thing over a period of 2 years.
Right.
He would have enough money to shoot some stuff, and he'd shoot it, and then he would run out of money, and they'd have to stop shooting. And so what happened is, partway in this, he had two aspects which I thought were absolutely incredible. One was he had an army officer whose rank wavered between captain and colonel. Senselessly. On some of the scenes, he had the captain's bars. On other scenes, he had a colonel's eagles. There was also an actor in there who was reasonably bald. And
Right. Somewhere
down the line, he bought a hairpiece. And in some of the scenes, and of course it was shot out of sequence, in some of the scenes he had hair, and other scenes he didn't have hair. So when this thing came into my possession, there was one thing the lab hadn't told me,
right,
and that was that the slates had been cut off. So I had to sync this thing up by eye, which was very irritating. But I decided it had to be done as a satire,
right,
which was not Bill Rebane's intention. But to me, that was the only way to make this thing fly, was as a satire.
Right.
And that was our campaign. An astronaut went up, but guess what came down? Something like that. And so that became the movie. And
right,
what is strange about it is I totally forgot about the whole thing, except that about a year and a half ago,
right,
there was a big squabble about who owned the original footage for that movie. And I was waited upon by both Bill Rebane, from whom I hadn't heard in what, 30 years or so,
right,
and another fellow named Jeff Hogue, who also claimed ownership of this thing. I told them to scrabble it out.
Listening to that segment with our special guest, Professor Jordan Lewis. In our final segment, we discussed Call Me Blood Red, Taste of Blood, Bruce and Gleason, Something Weird, The Psychic, Magical, and How to Do, Stewie the Boy Wonder, and so on and so forth. I'm a hero for that.
Mark Polonia.
And this is Tim Ritter.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Be there or be square.
Call Me Blood Red, I'll just touch on quickly. For me, at least, it was the least of the initial gore films. You know, I enjoyed the kids and their beach frolics more than Adam Sorg and his antics, because he didn't have that same intensity and goofiness of Fuad Ramsey's or the jovial lunacy of Mayor Buckman and the Townies in 2000 Maniacs. How did you feel about that film? Was it, you know, an important one for you, or did you feel that it didn't work as well?
Well, I felt and feel the same way you do. The
right,
fellow who played that role, his real name was Gordon Osheim, and in another movie we used the name Adam Sorg, and he picked
right,
that up as the name he would use because he also was a member of Screen Actors Guild. He was the sheriff in
Moonshine Mountain.
But it didn't have the spontaneity. And that was the movie on which Dave Friedman and I split up. So he took over the editing of that movie. In fact, Bob Sinise, who was Gary Sinise's father, did the actual cutting of that movie later on. Dave and I, as I think you are aware, were estranged for about 2 years. And then we ran into each other at a theater owners convention and made it all up.
After that, you moved on to Taste of Blood, which is enjoyable, but it's a bit over long. So why such a long running time? Well, the average drive-in exploitation film generally runs an hour to an hour and a half.
It was time to make one that had substance to it. A Taste of Blood really was going to be my Gone with the Wind. It didn't turn out that way. And if you saw it on a DVD, I can only apologize on behalf of Mike Braney and Something Weird Video that turned that out. Because what happened on the DVD, and originally on the video cassette of that movie, is day for night we had shot using a polarizing lens. Somebody in a laboratory didn't realize what we had and brightened those things up so that there's back and forth between dark and light was not the intention, and it's not that way in the 35-millimeter print. It is that way in the movie itself. I was a little uneasy here because A Taste of Blood runs 2 hours. That meant the prints cost a lot more to make. And looking at the industry from a business point of view, that gave me pause. On the other hand, with even tonight, there are those who say that A Taste of Blood had production values that many of the other pictures didn't have.
Oh, yeah.
To me, that's not quite the right way to keep score. But it runs 2 hours, and I don't apologize for it.
So was this your only on-screen cameo?
Oh, no. I was in Living Venus. I had little bits and pieces. In this case, I had no choice whatever. We wanted somebody with a limey accent who's on this boat. He's, "Evening, Mike. I ain't a fit not for the devil." Mm-hmm. And I had this fellow who was perfect for that part. He was supposed to show up. Now, we shot this on the docks at Miami,
which there's a place where the longshoremen reign supreme, and you don't mess around with longshoremen on the docks of Miami or any place. So we had the use of the boat. It was called the Kinderdunk. I remember the name of the boat, for 1 hour. And that was it. We had to be on the boat, shoot the scene, get off in 1 hour. We had it from 6 to 7, and I was getting very nervous because here we had agreed everybody was going to be there at 4 o'clock. This guy didn't show. He was a motorcycle rider, which had me a little uneasy to start with. 4 came, he wasn't there. 4:30 came, he wasn't there. 5 o'clock, he wasn't there. He was unreachable. So what was I going to do? I needed someone who could do a limey accent. I was it. And so I figured no one will know who this is. One of the guys on the crew who had hair going down his back gave me some hair to make a mustache. I pulled a stocking cap deep over my head, and I figured nobody will know. Yeah, right. We were mixing the sound, and I'm on there with, "Evening, mighty, ain't a bit not for the devil." And the guy in the sound, "What are you doing in there?" I said, "Oh, my God, I'm unmasked." But no, I had a scene in Living Venus where the fellow who plays the lead said, "Your art is kind of," I was a cartoonist, "your art is kind of flat." And I had this picture of a rather buxom girl, and I said, "Flat?" That was my part in Living Venus. Of course, at that time, I was a member of Screen Actors Guild. So that was totally legitimate. If you go to the Uh-Oh Show, I introduced that thing on camera. So I'm all over the place there. This wasn't a case of avoiding it. It was a case of feeling I was better off behind the camera than in front of it.
Everyone refers to your gore trilogy, and yet you were still making gore films again, The Gruesome Twosome being the first. I particularly liked that whole Nancy Drew, Scooby-Doo, mystery-solving aspect and approach to the picture. It gave a level of innocence and naivete very much akin to that of Blood Feast, if not more, dare I say, wholesome and representative of early to mid-60s Americana. It was like an Archie comic with a pair of psychos thrown in for good measure.
Well spoken. I wish I had known you then. You could have done some of my campaigns for me. The reason they regard those first three as the Blood Trilogy is because those are the three in which I was involved with Dave Friedman. And it was when we didn't plan it as a trilogy. So that was three films, and I, as far as I was concerned at the time, we were going on and on. But that's when he settled with Kohlberg and moved to California. So that was the end of that until we made Blood Feast 2 some years later, where Dave became executive producer.
Now, I know you get asked this one a lot, but it's so absurd and funny. Tell us about the whole rather lengthy talking wig intro, because I never failed to get a huge laugh out of when the hands come out and slash the throat on the one.
I made another mistake there in counting on other people's talents. When we shot The Gruesome Twosome, I had somebody who was counting running time. That is, how long is our movie going to be? And that person had to know roughly how long, for example, and what you call it, MOS, mid-out sound, what scene would be, where this is going to take about 2.5 minutes. That's going to be so long. I had to have a movie that I had to reach a minimum length. And he said, "Well, you've got 78 minutes. I said, "Great." So we finished shooting, came back to Chicago, cut this thing, and it ran at about 64 minutes. I said, "Now what?" Way off. That's when the talking head sequence came to play. I had to have something to fill that thing up with. It was added after the movie was done just to give us the amount of running time so we could go to a theater and say, "Play this picture." But they were not about to accept the 64-minute picture. It was really a post-completion activity.
But you have to wonder what they were thinking when they screened that, and there's like 10, 15 minutes of that.
Well, I didn't. What else would I do? The cast had scattered. I wasn't going to go back to Florida to try to pick them up to add more stuff to this movie, which already was fattened out beyond any logical point. What is funny about all of this is that there are those who think that is the best movie I made. I don't agree with that. I don't think any of the movies I made were that good, but so what? It's a business.
Exactly. So what was the whole story behind the psychic and its more entertaining sister film, Something Weird? You know, Elizabeth Lee made quite a fetching witch.
Well, there's a fellow named Jim Hurley who was a faculty member at a small university near Chicago called Triton College.
Right.
And Jim Hurley, with whom I'd had a minor social relationship, wanted to make a movie. And he literally was he financed this thing. Right. And we made Something Weird, and he didn't like it. He was a friend of a fellow who billed himself as an actual psychic and claimed that he helped the FBI track down criminals. His name was Olaf somebody or other.
which I found rather amusing. But Jim Hurley took this very, very seriously. And after we made Something Weird, he was unhappy with that movie altogether, and he wanted to make one of his own.
Right.
And that's where The Psychic came from. So I simply acted as his cameraman on that movie. Later
right.
on, I heard that he had made a deal with Stan Kohlberg for distribution of that movie, and Kohlberg always wanted to put the name Copenhagen in a movie. That was box office. I think he called it Copenhagen Psychic Loves or something like that. Made no sense whatever. But I was glad by that time I was all done with Stan Kohlberg. But Jim Hurley was simply, I won't call him an intruder into the movie business, but he wasn't part of the main line.
Around this time is where you started to branch out into other more established drive-in exploitation genres, the J.D. film, the biker film, the kiddie film. I mean, you had Jimmy the Boy Wonder, which at least was appropriately surreal with Mr. Fig and his great theme song, and The Magic Land of Mother Goose, where you literally filmed a stage play in what appeared
That's
to be a high-school auditorium.
I do not want credit or blame for The Magic Land of Mother Goose. It was a fellow named Jim Baker who had a show, a live show, and when a theater would be playing an adult movie,
right.
on Saturday and Sunday afternoon, they would open the curtains and there'd be this live show called The Magic Land of Mother Goose, a live show. He came to the conclusion, which very logically I thought, if he filmed this thing, instead of being in one theater, he could be in a number of theaters at the same time. It was especially true if a chain of theaters would play the same adult movie, and they'd all be open on Saturday and Sunday, but he could only supply cast for one show. So I was simply hired to film The Magic Land of Mother Goose. That was my entire participation. And we shot it on a stage somewhere using two cameras. There was nothing to it because he staged the show and I photographed it. Somehow later on, it became known as one of my movies. It wasn't.
And how about Jimmy the Boy Wonder? How did you get involved in that one?
Jimmy the Boy Wonder was the brainchild of a man named Hal Berg, whose wife, Frances somebody, had a children's show in Chicago. And Hal Berg wanted to star his wife in a movie. And it had to be a children's movie because her television show was a children's television show. And so off we went to Florida to shoot that movie. There was nothing to that either.
So,
really very simple. Larry Wellington, who was doing music for me when I wasn't scoring it myself,
right.
came up with a notion of Mr. Fig. And we threw that into the mix.
That was great.
In fact, there was a song called I'm Mr. Fig. Yes, he's Mr. Fig. I never dance. I do a jig or something like that. And so that was Jimmy the Boy Wonder.
Then you had a few Nancy Lee Noble films on the JD end. You had The Girl, the Body, and the Pill, and Just for the Hell of It, and then She Devils on Wheels. And you also had the wild guitar-esque Blast Off Girls, and then Alley Tramp, which all more or less fall under the JD umbrella. Blast Off Girls had the unique distinction of having Curler Harlan Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken fame appear on screen for a minute or so.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was easy enough. We always would make a deal with somebody to shoot a scene in exchange for lunch for everybody. At the time, early on, I had an advertising account called Chicken Unlimited. We had an open deal with Chicken Unlimited to shoot a scene in one of their restaurants in exchange for lunch for everybody. I did that also with Church's Fried Chicken for Year of the Yahoo.
Right.
In the case of Blast Off Girls, I had made a deal with the company that owned then Kentucky Fried Chicken to shoot one of their stores in Wilmette near Chicago. A couple of days before we started to shoot, I think they had no notion of the kind of movies I was making. They said, Harlan Sanders is going to be in town. Do you want him in your movie? I said, absolutely. Who was going to turn that down?
Right.
So he showed up with his entourage. And it was a peculiar experience because he wanted to shoot. There was nothing to his scene, really. He wanted to shoot it over and over and over again to the point where everybody was laughing except me. We were shooting 35-millimeter movie film. Finally, because it became absolutely impossible, we said, we'll have to break this down because we've got to go elsewhere. We used one of the takes that we had.
I've never regretted
having Colonel Sanders in the movie.
Oh, not at all. And he must have enjoyed his brush with fame because he appeared a year or two later in Al Adams' Hell's Bloody Devils as well. But
we may have started a new career for him in his dotage.
But in terms of Just for the Hell of It, I was quite amused by some of the antics of Destruction Incorporated, particularly when they stuck the baby in the car fan.
We tried to find anything that we could find that was totally repulsive, and that
that was one of them. By the way, one of the people, the fellow with the crutches that they knock apart, that
right.
was Patterson, the guy who did Dr. Gore.
Those were, for the most part, a real female biker gang and She-Devils on
wheels? Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, I had a choice to make. I could have actresses and then substitute bikers for them for long shots, or I
right.
could have people who actually rode the big, the Hogs and the Nortons and the Beamers and so on. To me, there was no decision at all. Because acting talent is secondary in this kind of movie. And I
right.
find we achieved verisimilitude that you can't get when some delicate actress suddenly takes off on a motorcycle and runs through plate glass windows and that kind of thing. No, these were actual bikers. In many cases, it was their first and last movie, as far
right.
as I know. But I had no regrets, and that movie really did well at the box office.
Oh, yeah, it was
and
great.
I suspect it might have been because people recognized them for what they were, genuine bikers.
You also made what may be one of my favorite of your films during this period, the wife-swapping classic Suburban Roulette with Bill Kerwin and Vicki Miles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was actually the last of your films that had one of those catchy theme songs that you were writing.
I don't remember how... Well, no, I wrote the music for Blood Feast 2, which Jackie Morgan produced, and the music for the new one, or at least the theme song for the Uh-Oh Show. But that may well have been, yeah.
There were a number of wife-swapping swinger key party films released around this period from folks like yourself and Joe Sarno and so forth. Was it as big a trend during that era as the films might suggest?
I didn't care. We could say that it was, whether it was or not, because people are often titillated by what they see rather than what they are involved in. So we gave them that slice of life, which we really did slice up.
So around this time, you started tapping into a few films that didn't work quite as well as the rest, like How to Make a Doll, for example, Miss Nymphette Zappin, and This Stuff Will Kill You. Were you running up against changing times? Because these films
yes,
feel...
indeed, I was. A fellow named Dave Chudnow, who had made movies in California for an expiring production company called Pine Thomas, wanted to make movies. Now, Dave had something that I really liked, and that was he had access to enough money to make whatever movie he wanted to make. Now, How to Make a Doll was written by his wife, Rosamond,
right.
who wanted to be involved in the movie business and never had the opportunity when Dave worked for Pine Thomas to do that. And I
right.
didn't care, because by that time it was running on fumes anyhow. And as you are very much aware, you may I admire what the research you've done here. I'll make a movie anytime anybody wants to. If this afternoon the phone rings and somebody says, hey, let's make a movie. Yeah, when do you want to start shooting, tomorrow?
Now, there are also a few lost films around this time, Ecstasies of Women, Linda and Abilene, and most
Those
disappointingly,
are both Tom Dowd's movies.
And Black Love, which I'd love to have seen. Is there any truth to the longstanding rumor that the Manson family was on hand during the filming of Linda and Abilene at Spawn
Absolutely
Ranch?
Absolutely, it's true, and it is true. It was. We shot that at the Spawn Ranch in California. And here were these people. We didn't know who they were. We only knew that they were a mean, vicious gang. And the
right.
people at the Spawn Ranch said, stay away from these people. And they
right.
had a dog, and they put a bell around the dog's neck. And every time the dog would run around, the bell would drive the dog absolutely nuts. He was trying to get the thing off. It was sickening. I said, get that bell off that dog. No, don't
right.
go near it. Don't go near it. You want to live till tomorrow? Don't go near that.
Wow.
So, yes, they were there.
So one film I really liked a lot, which I wasn't expecting to, was Year of the Yahoo, where you really skewer the American political process and how the media and special interests create and direct the public image of what amounts to a public candidate, you know, an image with no real bearing on the reality of the situation. It was quite a cynical and honest assessment of systematic corruption that's only gotten worse in the intervening decades.
Well spoken. Well, Year of the Yahoo, I felt, should have had more exposure. And by the way, I wrote all the songs for that one, too. A fellow named Claude King, who had one hit record called Wolverton Mountain, played the lead in Year of the Yahoo. And I have always felt that Year of the Yahoo did not get, I won't say the accolade, that's the wrong word, but the exposure it really could have deserved.
Now, this may have been your only truly political film, so what inspired it? Because my father was very much like Hank Jackson, a very direct and honest man of deeply held principles who found his time in even local politics to be quite disillusioning and difficult on both himself and our family, because it's really a game of shysters and manipulators. Nobody really goes in to make a difference or finds they can do so without playing the game by some dirty rules.
Well, you've also described the film business. All right, I've got to get off the phone here, but I really have enjoyed this conversation. Let's condense, but let's do it.
finally you made your last two Gore films, and you really went out with a bang. Wizard of Gore was really something else, and Gore Girl Girls, while a bit mean-spirited, followed a similar pattern. I noticed that the main characters, as in Gruesome Twosome before them, were quite likable and relatively well-written. I like the talk show host from Wizard, and the banter back and forth between Frank Kress and Amy Farrell was priceless. If it wasn't for the often extreme gore, this would have been the sort of film like my wife would love. It almost harkens back to an earlier screwball comedy style of writing.
Well, the Gore Gore Girls, I thought at the time, would be the last movie I ever made. So I felt I'd pull out all the stops on that. And it emphasized what had evolved from the viewpoint, you might say, of film going. Anybody who saw that movie, and that was way ahead of its time, anyone under age, let's say 40, thought it was a real hoot. Anybody over age 60 felt I should be strung up by my thumbs for making a movie like that. And what's strange about that is with the Gore Gore Girls, that attitude seems to have prolonged itself even up till today. That movie was really the kind of movie that I think if I were starting to make this kind of movie, I would make a movie like that now. But I made that a long time ago.
So how did you snag Henny Youngman, of all people, for the strip club owner?
The script for the Gore Gore Girls was written by a young man named Alan Dockman. His father, Bob Dockman, was a member of the Chicago Variety Club along with me. And he said, hey, my son has written a screenplay. If you'll produce it, I'll get it financed. Now, who's going to say no to that? It turned out also that Henny Youngman was a close friend of Bob Dockman. He said, if you can get him done in one day, I'll get Henny Youngman for you. And what's funny about that, Henny Youngman, he was there for the day. We really milked him, too. He talked so fast, I said, Henny, if you keep this up, I'm going to have to put English subtitles under your lines. And that slowed him down. Years later, when asked about this, Henny Youngman denied being in the movie. But it's like that Charles Adam cartoon that shows an elephant. The guy says, what elephant? How can you deny being in a movie in which you have as many lines as he had in that movie?
So after the Gore Gore Girls, you effectively retired from the film industry for a long time and went to work in direct marketing, publishing numerous books and conducting seminars. So now we have most of these films on DVD thanks to Mike Vranney and Something Weird. I understand that he dragged you down to a hotel room that could record 9 commentaries in a single day.
Yes, we did. It wasn't a hotel room. It was, I think, my living room. We looked at these things silent and just made our comments as we went along. Everything is casual. I really feel sorry for people who take the industry so seriously that they have to have a committee meeting before they'll make a statement.
Well, with that, Herschel, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and we'd love to have you back in the future to discuss your more recent films or any other projects you have on tap. And speaking as a huge fan, let me close by saying thank you for all the films.
Well, thank you for saying thank you. I love you, too. Okay, I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up-close and personal interview with Herschel Gordon Lewis. Next week on week 37 of Third Eye Cinema, Mother Leone of Chastain. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician and like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com. Visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema, or our new website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. part of this or any Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listen or download at your convenience.